I'm staring at the eviction notice. I'm frozen, terrified. I'm thinking about Laura, my little daughter, and my baby who'll be born into homelessness. Today, I can tell you straight up, if it wasn't for Threshold and the people who donate to them, me and my girls would be homeless.
Threshold saves 9 families every day from homelessness. Please support our At Home for Christmas appeal. Help us stop homelessness before it happens.
Visit threshold.ie to make an instant Christmas donation.
Welcome to Reboot Republic, the podcast that goes behind the headlines and looks at the big issues in this republic of inequality. We are the podcast of solutions and the podcast of hope. And I'm your host, Rory Hearn. And I'm delighted to be joined today on the podcast, back on the podcast. He's been a guest before. A lecturer of mine who is very well known to you listeners and someone who has been doing incredible work in housing for many, many, many decades. It is none other than Professor PJ Drudy, who is a Professor Emeritus of Economics in Trinity College Dublin and author of a great book, Out of Reach, The Irish Housing Crisis, which is a fantastic book. PJ, it is wonderful to have you back on the podcast.
Good to see you, Joe Rory, an old student of mine. One of the best, really, I'd have to say, despite being, you know, too bright for your boots, really, at the time. I thought this guy's very bright. Bright students always give trouble, you know, Tony or Rory. But honestly, you were a very, very good student, very bright student. It was a treat to have you in the class, really. I have a feeling one of those classes was development, the economics of less developed countries. Maybe it wasn't. Was there some other one?
That's correct. Now, PJ, we're both thank you for the very kind words, which I absolutely did not pay you to say. We're both going back now because I was thinking it was 2000 when I graduated. So I had you for third year and fourth year in. I think I did at least 3 economics modules with you. I think we did the economics of urban development. We did economics of definitely, I think, as well, less developed countries. And we did another one on. Trying to remember, but I actually remember the lectures. Would you believe? I actually remember going into the lectures and you putting up the, of course, it would have been the board and it would have been the pull down slide things.
Oh, yeah, long before the internet wasn't working at all, I think.
No. So you would have been using those slides you put on, those graphs you put on an overhead projector thing.
That was it.
And then you would draw on the board and you draw the graph of the demand supply, and you'd basically say, now this doesn't work in housing, and you'd start talking about housing and waiting lists and urban property, and it were fascinating lectures. So it was a privilege to have you. So many people should really blame you for creating me.
Oh well, no, you were your own man, Rory. But yes, it was a great pleasure to have people like you. Really, I've had quite a number of lovely, wonderful, bright students, and it is a great pleasure to feel that. Well, you were your own man, really, Rory. But I suppose I was delighted when people kind of agreed with my ideas. They might have happened before me, and no doubt you had your own notions long before you met me. But basically, you and I would be on the same wavelength. We were asking questions like, "What kind of society do we actually want?" And will the economics resolve it? And of course, the honest answer, you mentioned supply and demand there. Economics will not on its own resolve very much, to be honest with you, because this supply and demand, we're talking about the market there when you talk about supply and demand, you know, with suppliers producing food or producing houses or whatever, and on the consumers then demanding those things. Those two concepts are interesting, but demand is worth looking at for a second. Demand is not just wishing to have something.
Yeah.
Economics. Demand implies that people have the ability to pay for a product or a service. Now, that is why economics is irrelevant for many people, because many, many people have not the ability to pay for a house. They have the ability to get a loan. They haven't the ability even to pay sufficient for food for themselves. So, I mean, a lot of economics is to do with the market, the market, the market. And the market does not apply to very considerable numbers of people. And that's why governments need to intervene. But kind of going on, what kind of society? Well, do we want a society where a large number of families can't afford to buy or rent a home or are forced to remain on waiting lists for donkey's years? Do we want a society where timely access to the best health services are available only to those who have high incomes? Do we want a society where children and adults with disabilities, as well as their parents, perhaps, don't get appropriate respite or care? So there's a whole range of questions where economics does not resolve the problem. Housing, health, education. If you were to leave those matters to the market, supply and demand, well, of course, only those with money. Remember the ability to pay point I made earlier. Only those with money would get them. Now, that's why people like yourself and myself have for years been saying, well, really, the private sector on its own, the market on its own, will not resolve our problems. And therefore, that any responsible government must make appropriate interventions. Now, it's interesting in housing that the government, you would expect them to be always making appropriate interventions. But what they do regularly is they intervene in the wrong. They, for example, they have a help to buy scheme where they're trying to prop up people who are purchasing homes. All that does is increase the price. Because they're putting money in on top of people who may not be able to repay that loan, but they're keeping the prices up. What we want, and what you want, I'm sure, is to keep the prices down and bring them down. They're far too high. And rents are far too high. So kind of economics is problematic. You know, its concepts are very limited and they have very limited application. And that's the problem in universities, that really students are taught, given supply and demand, this is the constant regular diet they get in first year and indeed right through university, if they're willing to take it, you weren't. But these concepts imply that the market works and there's no case for government intervention. So I've talked too much, Rory.
No, not at all. Not at all. It's fascinating. And you're bringing me back to those days in Trinity and when I used to love listening to you. And you absolutely, because you see, where you're coming from is a place of values. And, you know, your starting question is what type of society we want, which is not where economics starts from. The theory of economics starts from the utilitarian individual maximizing, you know, that's what we're all about, maximizing profit. You know, you start from, like, their assumptions that economics starts from are, you know, they're capitalist assumptions. They're assumptions that people are just out to make profit, businesses are just out to make profit. We're all these utility maximizing individuals who are essentially selfish. And that's the way we work. And we're rational beings and we operate accordingly. And therefore, the best way to allow society operate is this, allow the demand and supply operate, and the hidden hand of the market will sort things out. Because if supply is falling and there's a demand, then supply will increase, the prices will increase, and the increase in prices leads to then people will produce that thing because they see there's a profit being made. And at some point there'll be this magic point of equilibrium where the two graphs cross each other, the two lines cross each other within the graph, and that's within the graph, and that's the optimum supply point. But as you say, whatever about bananas and cars, it doesn't work in housing.
No, not at all. And I mean, it's interesting, those two concepts are thrown around, and the market, this word, the market, is used all the time. But I mean, the problem is that there are a small number of suppliers and a large number of people desperate to get a home.
Yeah.
So inevitably, the price goes crazy up. And even in the old days, in the early 2000s, even though supply was increasing, people were still buying houses because at that time the banks were throwing money at them.
Yeah.
They were raising the demand and allowing them to buy at extortionate prices. So, but in general, I think we're agreed that economics is problematic. it's problematic. The assumptions, you mentioned assumptions, that's an important point, the assumptions. The assumption of a perfect market is thrown around in textbooks all the time.
Yeah.
Now, there's no such thing as a perfect market. Perfect market would imply that you have large numbers of suppliers and large numbers of consumers.
Yeah.
And therefore, competition drives down the price. And between the two of them, prices will kind of reach a so-called equilibrium. Now, it's irrelevant. There's no equilibrium. It never happens. It never happens. It's always out of kilter. Because, in effect, markets fail practically all the time. All right, televisions, calculators, computers, it may work for them. But certainly in the case of something like housing, which is a human right, as you've often said on your programs and in your book, you cannot apply the same sort of concepts to housing as you do in general economics.
But yeah.
In general, I would say be wary of economic concepts. Always be critical of them. If you're doing economics, just ask constant questions. Is this relevant or is it just an abstraction?
Because I was even thinking, because there's a big debate ongoing that, you know, I know you're very well aware of at the moment about the whole build to rent and the investor funds providing housing and the sort of, there's a lot of economic commentators like, you know, people from Davy, stockbrokers and others, do you know what I mean, economists and some who have very clearly vested interests and others who aren't necessarily vested interests, but absolutely are arguing in favor of that we need the increased investment funds to provide the likes of build to rent. And they're arguing that if you question that or criticize it or oppose it, that you're opposing a supply and that really they're arguing that this is the supply we need, that supply will bring down prices, supply will bring down rents. But someone was making the point to me the other day that when I was discussing this with them, that housing is fundamentally different because you don't reach a point. It's not like you can choose because they constantly say, oh, it's just like cars. Like, you know, if we provide BMWs, you know, then eventually people will, you know, if they don't want to buy them, they'll sit in the showroom. Fine. You know, it's not an issue, you know, but you're like, hang on a minute. People are desperate for a home. They will pay whatever is the going market rate, whatever is the cost to get a home. So there's no point at which they'll go, do you know what? I think I won't actually pay that rent because, you know what, I don't need a home. Of course, you know, so it's flawed, the idea that this increased investor supply at a high end leads to reduced prices, or is it?
Well, I'll agree completely with it. I have a real problem with these institutional investors, really. They've come in here because they're money flowing around in their bank accounts and they're not able to get high returns in other mechanisms. So they come in to the likes of Ireland. Of course, they're all over the world now. It's a global issue. And they come and they realize that people are desperate to, they cannot buy because they cannot afford to. And they're desperate. They want a home. They want to get out of living on the couch in their parents' home or whatever. So they're prepared to pay. And so it's profit driven. It's greed driven. And it's wrong. So, I mean, in my view, the government, this is where governments come in. Why wouldn't the government build sufficient housing itself? And rent them at affordable rents where people can afford to pay. I mean, all these extortionate rents that are paid and extortionate house prices that are paid by some who manage to get money is a waste of money, really, if you think about it, because then so much money has to be invested in rent or in purchase that people cannot spend them on other employment-creating activities. So it's quite mad. So I would say, certainly, I've seen so many people, Mr. Farrell recently, the Pat Farrell, who's the CEO of an institutional investment fund, commenting and saying they're the answer to prayer. Well, I completely disagree with them. They're not the answer to prayer because they're charging extortionate rents. And by the way, they are a monopoly in many parts of Dublin now.
Yeah.
Where they own significant amounts of the property there, 30, 40% in some parts of Dublin. Now, a monopoly is a bad, even economists accept that monopoly is a bad idea. And really, therefore, government has to sit up. And of course, you know that in relation to the institutional funds, what Mr. Noonan did some years ago when he was Minister for Finance, he gave them a tax holiday, a capital gains tax holiday for 7 years. I mean, it was sort of disgraceful to give that sort of a tax holiday to these institutional funds who were going to charge extortionate rents to our people. It was wrong. So at the end of the day, you keep coming back to what is right and what is wrong here. And you keep coming back to the question of people having a human right to something like a house. We can never forget that, Rory.
But I absolutely agree with you, PJ. And for me, that's the starting point. The starting point is housing is a human right and everybody needs one. But just to put that to you again, because there's really strong kickback at the moment. And as I said, it's not just the economists. It is gaining some support amongst, obviously it's supported by government and others, but it is gaining some support, the idea that, all supply is good supply, and that this, we need, that the academic, this is what has been said, the academic points to everywhere where there's an increased supply of housing at the high end, it will lead to a fall in house prices and rents.
Well, I'd love to see the evidence, Rory. I mean, you can abstract as much as you like, and economists are good at it. I mean, I was brought up that way, really. But I mean, you do grow up in due course, and you realize that abstraction is a complete waste of time. There's no evidence for what you've just said or what is contended. You didn't say it. It's contended that prices will drop. Now, you can look at the situation of house prices. Since 1995, they've been escalating. And apart from a very short period from about 2008, 2009 to about 2011, apart from that, the house prices have gone not exactly perpendicular, but certainly massively increased in comparison with other indicators like the consumer price index or the wages or the cost of building. So, I mean, there's a gap, there's a massive gap between house prices and other normal indicators. And that is the rip-off factor. I would call that the rip-off factor by the private sector, including, of course, institutional funds. So, I mean, I cannot accept, you can argue, yes, any supply is good, of course, but any supply isn't always good if an extortionate price is being charged to our people. And if there's a monopoly, that's not good supply.
Yeah, yeah. Where do you see this going? Do you think, like, we saw a report came out from KPMG there in terms of the Dublin City Development Plan in Cork saying that house prices are likely to increase by another, you know, factor of 8 to 10%, 30% should I say, over the next 8 years, rents even more, 50%. Like, is this just going to continue increasing?
But you see, these people are making assumptions that everything is going to go on as it has gone on and that nothing will be done. And that's, well, it's very unfair to our people, first of all, but it's wrong, because if we had a government that took this matter very, very, very seriously and ensured an increase in supply, then that of the right kind and at appropriate, reasonable prices, then of course you wouldn't have an increase in the cost of purchase or the cost of rent. You wouldn't. But it does demand that governments pay heed. Now, in fairness to them, Housing for All does claim that it's going to build 9,000 homes per annum over the next, is it 5 years? And they're claiming that they'll build cost rental homes, or a small number over the next, whatever it is, 2 or 3 years. Now, that will help, but it's not enough. You have to have a very significant supply. And don't tell me that the provision of HAP to people in the private rented is an answer to that. It's not. That delivers housing to people supported by the government for a short time. But the real answer is that the state has to take a very serious role. I mean, very, very serious role, and not be just messing around doing small amounts at the edges. We have to do a Vienna model, if you like. Look at other countries, what they've done. Vienna is a good example of cost rental, where people can purchase or rent a home now for perhaps 600, 700 less than 1,000 per month, in comparison with the sort of things that are going on in this country, 2,000, 2,500 per month. So at the end of the day, maybe I'm being over, I don't think I'm being oversimplistic, actually, Rory. No, I think I'm right in saying that this, there has to be competition with the private sector. The private sector has not delivered, Rory.
Yeah.
It only delivered 15,000 homes last year. In 2006, I think, they delivered 75,000, all built in the wrong places. The private sector is a mess. They're not just doing the business. They're not fit for purpose. Now, of course, there are good people in that business, but they're not delivering the numbers. And so what is the alternative? The only alternative is for the state to play a very, very, very serious role. Cost rental is a good, for in the rental system, social housing has to be produced. And of course, by the way, rents have to be collected. It's wrong that people, when they get a social housing unit, simply refuse to pay the rent, even though they have sufficient money to pay the rent. There's something wrong with that. There's considerable rent arrears in this country in the various county councils, and that's wrong. Because that's why the county councils have tended to say, oh, I won't build social housing. I'm going to have nothing but trouble with it. There won't be the rents and so on. So, but that's not a big deal to resolve. But social housing and cost rental housing would be a competitor with purchase. People would say if they had a social housing unit or a cost rental housing unit that they could afford, they wouldn't bother purchasing, or at least they'd put off purchasing for a very long time.
Well, so, I think as well, there's no reason why the government shouldn't be supported the building of affordable housing for purchase alongside that as well.
That's another, absolutely.
No, like the Ó Cualann is doing it out in North Dublin and...
Yes, I think Ó Cualann is an excellent example. Actually, I'm hoping very much, Rory, to do business with Ó Cualann myself, because I'm chairperson of a housing association, St. John of God Housing Association, where we're providing homes for people with disabilities. And I'm very much hoping that we've had a meeting with, in fact, Hugh Brennan recently, and I'm hoping that we would perhaps do a deal with Hugh. And that man is very, very committed. There's no question to affordable and social housing.
Yeah,
what we're in.
It shows what's possible, and yeah, maybe you could talk a little bit about that, about what you're doing on that, and obviously it's very personal to you as well.
Ah, yes, I've got a handicapped son of 33 years of age now. He's actually in a residential place. St. John of God Housing Association provided a home for him with he's sharing with others.
Yeah, and
he's quite happy, really, but that situation faces an awful lot of people, you see. If you have a handicapped son or daughter and they're in their late 20s, into their 30s, and you're getting old, you say, well, what is going to happen when I die? That's a very important, crucial question for many, many people. And many, many parents now today are either elderly or ill, and they're having to contend with a disability at home. And the disability could be quite severe. Demand perhaps that one parent gives up a job, or even two parents gives up their jobs. So it's an enormous problem. So our housing association provides, we have 189 properties all over Ireland now. We have them in Kerry, we have them in Dublin, Louth, Kildare. They're the main areas. 189, and we're catering for around 350 tenants. But there's a massive shortfall. There's a massive number of families that are desperate, desperate, desperate for accommodation for their son or daughter. And we're trying to do that. And we're able to get, in fairness to the government, they are helpful to the housing association. They give us CAS funding. It's a capital investment scheme or a capital assistance scheme. And then there's another loan scheme that they are prepared to give us. And we're able to borrow money from the housing finance agency. And that's fine. We can produce the houses, but staffing is essential. Staff is essential. Now, you wrote about this, Rory, in a recent Examiner piece. You did an excellent piece on disability yourself, and you're very familiar with it. But staff support is absolutely central. And at the moment, the HSE provides the staffing, but insufficient being provided. There's a new report called the Disability Capacity Review has just appeared, and that suggests that at least 400 million is required in 2022 to provide staff support.
Yeah.
That is absolutely essential money. That's for the entire country. And if we got a tiny slice of that to provide care, we have a caring organization working alongside us called St. John of God Community Services. And that we need a fair slice of that money.
Yeah, it's I know when I was researching for that article, and the whole, you know, the scale really struck me. The scale of, you know, people with disabilities who are living at home with parents, that aging, because, you know, we talk about an aging crisis across the board in terms of, you know, people in the rental system who are aging and, you know, are looking down the line of, you know, will they be able to afford the rent? But you have, as you say, you know, many children living at home with parents, and, you know, the issue of, you know, still disabled people in institutions as well. But again, it's a great example in a way of, if you rely on the market, you know, the vulnerable lose out over and over, or not just lose out, but are excluded, their potential reduced, their, and it just, it shows to me like, yes, it's great the government is providing these loans, but it's only more recently. It's still insufficient in scale. As you say, then there's not the additional stuff around the HSC. It's back to that economics. We don't have a, as you say, you know, our economics is not an economics of caring, is it?
Correct.
That values care.
That's right. That's right. Care is excluded, sadly. Did you ever see in any of the texts you used in your 4 years in Trinity anything about care in one of the texts? I doubt it.
Very little.
I doubt it. Now, that's tragic, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
So I think what we need, Rory...
Care should be central to our economies and societies.
The likes of you now and your influence and influencing public opinion quite a lot, I think, really, and thankfully, really, on television or in your books and so on. I think we've got to persuade people that there's a new form of economics. And there are quite a number of people actually writing about a new form of economics, an economics of care. An economics of human rights. You know, this is what, like, what is development, Rory? Development is not economic growth. That's purely the growth of income. And as you know, incomes are very badly distributed, where some people have huge sums of money, huge incomes, millions perhaps, and then large numbers are down at the bottom with small incomes. So economic growth measuring income is an completely insufficient concept. We need to be thinking of development in a broader sense of income, okay, but also education, housing, health, equality. There's a whole range of concepts that have to be brought into the picture if you want development in any country, real development, human development.
Yeah, and of course, you know, we are seeing increasingly, you know, there is focus in economics on that broader question of societal well-being and you know, the human development indicators as measures. And we're seeing countries like New Zealand, you know, using these as key ways in which they measure the development, that the use of GDP as our measurement of, you know, how a society is doing is just flawed. And then you add on the climate, you know, how it doesn't consist. I remember back to Trinity, my other economics lecture from Danny McCoy, no less, who taught me environmental economics. And I remember him talking about the externalities and you go, you know, the climate was never factored in as a cost, never,
sadly. No, there are very important concepts. Anyway, Rory, I mean, really, there are possibilities. We must not surrender to despair.
Absolutely not.
Hope. And, you know, if you listen to people out in the street, they have common sense. They want the sort of things that you and I are talking about today. I've not made up a lot. I'm reflecting what people say to me every day of the week.
Yeah.
They want affordable. I mean, I live in an estate now with many, many friends. And all of them say to me, my child, my son cannot afford to buy a house. My son cannot afford to pay the rent. They're relatively well-off people. And yet, their sons or daughters are reasonably well-employed. Yet they cannot. There's something wrong, fundamentally wrong with that.
Yeah.
So ethics comes into it. Where did any of us hear of ethics and economics? Fair play, human rights, ethics. These concepts are very, very important.
They are absolutely. And I'm really struck by, you know, what you're saying there, that in a sense, you know, the housing crisis for younger generations reaches across social classes.
It does.
And I think I see within that the possibility of real change and real hope, because the system has broken down for everybody now, except for the very, very, very wealthy. But for the majority of young people now growing up in Ireland, there's an absence of home, you know, an absence of even a future, you know, them looking to emigrate. And I think within that, if we can show that there's another way to do this, you know, that you can do this differently, and that it requires the state supporting housing associations, you know, guaranteeing and getting, you know, the Ó Cualáins, the not-for-profit providers, and, you know, that this is possible and that this is solvable. It seems to me that I wonder, because in the past, the political system, you know, when you've been, you know, researching this area, PJ, for I don't know how many years, 50 years. But like you were talking about going back to the 60s, you've seen all this. And like when we look at, because I would say like pre probably 1990s, maybe even pre 1980s, housing wasn't looked on as an asset, as an investment. The overall, like people in Ireland looked on housing as home, but something happened culturally. And, you know, was it that, you know, I know developers were always close to Fianna Fáil, but it was this idea in the Celtic Tiger that everybody, you know, particularly upper middle class, could become, you know, an investor, buy a second, third home. You know, the banks benefited, the developers benefited. And in many ways, we would say, did they dictate housing policy? And now who's dictating housing policy? Like, why is the government not going, they're not getting brown envelopes anymore from developers. They're not dependent on them. So why are they not going, well, actually, what people need is affordable homes. We can do it. We have the land. We can borrow. Like, to me, are they now captured by the investor lobby? What is it? In your big, long expanse of looking at this, PJ, what's your analysis?
But certainly, I think they are influenced by the investor lobby, by absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of lobbying going on that you and I don't know anything about.
Yeah.
Ministers are even, I saw recently that the Minister for Finance was even given the answers to certain questions that he was supposed to provide. He was supposed to provide answers as given to him by a lobbyist. I found that extraordinary.
Yeah.
And the Minister for Finance, I don't know who is actually a decent man. I would say an intelligent guy. I would hope that he wasn't influenced. But going back to the 60s, you mentioned the 60s. In the 1960s, people on sort of, and at that time, a fairly good salary would be £1,000 in old pounds. But a house could be purchased for around three times that figure, about 3,000.
Yeah.
The mortgage would be very relatively small and could be paid by one person. So the ratio between the house price and the salary was about 1 to 3. And I think that's a good ratio. But now, the ratio can be anything like 1 to 10, 1 to 9. It's crazy. Except in parts of the country, down the west, you will buy a house at a very reasonable price. But I mean, in the cities, Dublin, Galway, Limerick, Cork, house prices are out of kilter with salaries, really. And so the bank of mum and dad is called in, and mum and dad either is lucky enough to have money to be able to throw in money to their child, or they borrow the money to give to their child. And all that is doing, of course, is keeping the house prices up and is increasing inequality, in fact, between those who can buy and those who will never buy. So there's real problems in there. But there's a cultural change, you're right. Since the 60s, I never heard houses being talked about in terms of an asset, although, mind you, auctioneers were always saying it's the best investment you will ever make. You cannot go wrong. You cannot go wrong. You'll always gain. Now, that's a dreadful way of looking at housing. But I think in between, as you said, probably in the 90s in particular, and since then, it's been seen as this is a great investor. Sure, the institutional investors, that's what they see, housing as an asset.
Yeah.
They don't see it as a home. No way. And they see it as making as much money for them as possible. And they lobby government as much as they can to ensure that they don't tax them. And they give them every favor they can possibly get. So government is enamored of these institutional investors, sadly. But cultural change, how do you bring it about, Rory? Will you manage it on your own, on these programs of yours? I don't know.
Do you know what? The interesting thing is, I feel it is changing again. And
it is. It has to.
Yeah, it does.
Once the middle classes, the ones I've mentioned now in the estate I live in, once the middle classes are really worried about their sons and daughters, they will start to put on the pressure, and the voters, they're the voters. They're the ones who vote. And therefore, they'll hopefully put the pressure on government to sort it out. I mean, I did a seminar there recently for a group in Bray, all women, all sort of middle class women in their 50s and 60s or more elderly. And they were outraged by the housing crisis because their sons and daughters cannot either afford to buy or rent.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that the key thing, the cultural change that I think is underway, is that people have learned from the crash that housing is not, you know, a safe bet, that it is boom bust. Yep. People were so hurt in so many ways, really suffered. And we have this now generation who are been excluded. And I think in terms, there's an interesting thing I feel there's a real hope that the value shift that we saw in the likes of the repeal referendum, in the marriage equality referendum, younger people don't see the world the way people in their 60s and 70s in Ireland were brought up to see it, in that conservative way. They see it in the world as, you know, even my own teenage son, like who's in his older teens now, like he just sees everybody as equal. You know, people are just, you know, everybody has, you know, they're not prejudiced. They're not, you know, they have such an open, loving way, you know, they're led by their hearts.
Yeah.
And I feel that if we can, and I think they don't see housing as investment, they just want a home. They also don't want a home where they're paying $2,000 a month for a pokey apartment, you know? But I think if we can lead with the heart around housing, yes, you know, that I think that there's a real possibility of real change. And I feel it's coming. Like I feel it in my bones and my veins, it is coming. I think the question is how long it will take, not will we get there. And I hope it's a shorter time frame, and that's why I keep pushing.
Well, that's well said, Rory. I couldn't improve on that. The heart. And I agree with you. Young people are absolutely idealistic. They're not simply seeking profits and that sort of thing. They think of, we want a decent society.
Yeah.
Everyone is treated equally, where everyone has access to a home, where everyone has access to a reasonable job and reasonable, you know, they're wonderful. They're wonderful. I used to really, I miss that actually from Trinity, that young people really waking you up to how idealistic they are.
Yeah.
What an example they are to all of us.
Yeah.
All you and I can do is can copy them and try and emulate them, really.
That's it.
And encourage them, of all things, affirmation. Yeah. Affirm that sort of attitude.
Yeah.
And indeed persuade their parents that their young people are right.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's the really important conversation, because when you talk to your, you know, neighbors and they say, because the big thing I think government is politically playing with is that they have wanted house prices to rise for a number of reasons, and rents as well. On the one hand, they've wanted the banks. So the banks have been very influential in trying to, you know, overcome the crash, boost their balance sheets. Property is key to that. So they've wanted inflating prices to sort out the banks. So the economy is seen as working. Of course, it's a flawed assumption, but that's the basis on which their thinking has gone. And also in terms of NAMA, to keep selling off that to the investment funds, and to bring in the investors then. They've wanted rents. But I think the political calculation they made was that rising house prices suits the middle classes.
Oh yeah,
because they see the value of their house prices rising. It gets them out of negative equity and they all feel good about themselves and they feel good about us.
Yes, that's
but
right.
But I think the miscalculation is that the generation of kids of these middle class, and I think this is reaching the critical point, and this is the conversation we need to have, because I would say there's still a lot of older middle class people who still think rising property prices is a good thing. And but they, I think increasingly we need to have that conversation that in actual fact, the reason your kids can't get a home is because house prices continue to rise and rents continue to rise. So what we actually need is them to fall. And you can stay in your home, which you should be able to. Okay, the value of it is going to fall, but what does that matter in a real sense?
Well, we need to converse with the middle classes. There's no doubt about it, because they're the voters, really. But there are signs, indeed. I mean, the likes of Acoulon is a fantastic bright light on the horizon. There's no doubt.
Yeah, it is.
But even recently, Rory, I was talking at a meeting with a man called John Coleman, who's the chief executive of the Land Development Agency. Now, the Land Development Agency has received very bad press over the years because it was seen as a property developer's mechanism.
Yeah.
But talking to Coleman, he claimed to me and to a number of my colleagues on the Housing Association that they're moving almost exclusively to affordable and social housing.
Yeah.
Including cost rental. Now, if you could believe him, he even talked about, we're going to compete with the private sector. Now, that's exactly what is required. Because the LDA, if it's used properly, and if it's, you know, NAMA wasn't used properly, as you well know, that NAMA was used as a profit-making mechanism to get the money back that the government had given them and so on. I mean, NAMA was a disaster. But really, the LDA has the potential, if this man is telling the truth, I think I would be inclined to trust him, that they're focusing and going to focus on social and affordable housing. Now, the local authorities, of course, should be doing this also, and the housing associations. But if there's sufficient people doing affordable, and it could be, as you said, affordable to purchase, of course, why shouldn't it be? Because people have this aspiration of their own home and a little garden at the back. Now, I know that everyone is shouting about the need for apartments, but I'm not convinced about that, because having had children myself, even a small little back garden is quite important for safety for them when they're growing up.
Yeah.
I mean, I have a problem. I think apartments are wonderful for young people when they're young. But when they get married or have a partner and have a family, a little garden, however small, I think is important. Therefore, my concept of housing would be slightly different from apartments. But anyway, I see light on the horizon with the LDA. I hope I'm right, and I certainly hope I'm not wrong.
Yeah.
And it's a matter, I think, the likes of you and I have to influence agencies like that to do the right thing, to be a competitor with the private sector. And of course, the private sector have a role to play. Why shouldn't they? But they have just a role. They're not the role.
Yeah.
That's the issue.
Yeah. Well, listen, PJ, it's fantastic to have you on again. And just before you go, I'd like you to sort of expand on, for you, what is the meaning of home? Or if you were to define home, what is it?
Well, home for me is a place where you can pull the front door, no matter how small that front door, and walk into a little place that you can sit down, you can play your guitar or play your piano, which I do a little, and you can have a cup of tea, or you might even have a tin of beer or a glass of wine, and you feel, well, nobody's going to throw me out of here. So you feel secure, you feel safe, and you feel part of a community. You're living in the community with friends round about that you know, and you feel, if I'm in trouble, well, my friend next door or up the road will help me. So it's a place of security, of safety. You know, Rory, it's a very good question, because after the seminar that I mentioned earlier in Bray, there's a lady called Bridget O'Brien did a remarkable set of drawings, which were exhibited in the Mermaid Theatre in Bray there recently, on what is home. It was absolutely beautiful, where it showed an old boy sitting back in his chair, delighted with himself, and having a cup of tea. And it showed, another picture was a young fellow playing a guitar. It was in his own place. And another one showed somebody making bread, preparing a meal, and, you know, so on and so on. And basically, it was your own place. Do you remember the little poem, The Old Woman of the Road? You mightn't remember that, by Porlick Collum, I think. It was, "Oh, to have a little house, to own the hearth and all, and to be away from the wind and weather. To own the little home." Beautiful poem.
Yeah.
But it captured everything. So that's what home is. And you know, Darren, well, you're in agreement with me. I know you're in agreement with me on that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that that's what we need to reclaim. Absolutely. And talk about the value of home, not an economic value, no, but the value to us as human beings.
That's right. And price is not value, by the way. That's a huge mistake. Value is much more than price.
Yeah. Well, listen, I'm going to say thank you so much.
Thank you, Rory.
To not just coming on today to the podcast, but for teaching me and for nurturing me. And they were wonderful lectures.
Great pleasure. And I'm hoping you'll keep it up, Rory. And thank you for having me anyway. I mean, I enjoyed that. And I enjoyed listening to you, really, because you're getting better. Age is good for you, actually. The older you get, the better. And you're going to be fantastic in your 60s. You know. And by the way, we didn't talk about the activism, which is very important, actually. And you've done a lot of activism in your time, but riling people up.
Yeah.
And very important to rouse them up and say, we've got to resolve this.
Yeah.
So bring the population on board.
Yeah.
We need numbers. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah, it is. It is. And that's a real problem with COVID. Was I a bit mad as an activist when I was back in college?
Oh, I wouldn't have thought so. No, I think you were very reasonable, actually. And you were in large crowds who agreed with you. And
yeah. Yeah.
Why not? No.
Yeah.
No.
It's definitely, you know, you're right. And it is always something that I have found. You know, there's a power when you work together with lots of other people, and then that's the whole heart of what is a society as opposed to just individuals utility maximizing. But you are absolutely right. You do have to animate people. People have to raise their voice for the change to happen.
You have to persuade. Absolutely. Cajole.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thanks, Rory. Evan.
Thank you, PJ. Listen, lovely. And hopefully we'll talk to you again soon.
Stay in touch.
Yeah. And that was PJ Drudy there, Professor Emeritus of Economics from Trinity College, my old lecturer, fantastic man, just such a wealth of knowledge of housing and putting human rights at its center. The ideas there, I could listen back over to it a number of times to listen to his values and putting society first and the value of caring and what things should decide how we do housing. And I think really, I hope this gets a wide listenership. So I hope, ask you to listeners, please spread it around, share it out in social media if you can. You can go onto Spotify or onto Torzshack website and share the link and let people know. And we can engage in that, you know, that culture, persuasion, the change. And as always, too, please, we are an independent podcast, completely reliant on listeners. Thank you to our patrons who support us, who sign up, who contribute to us every month to keep the lights on, to keep the show going. The podcast is produced by Tony Groves of Tortoiseshack Media. Without Tony and Tortoiseshack Media, these podcasts wouldn't exist. So if you can, please go over to patreon.com/Tortoiseshack and sign up for whatever you can each month, and you will get the podcast first to you in your mailbox, in your email, before they go out. Generally, they go to patrons first. You also access the podcast across the platform, and you support us to keep going in this really important podcast of education and hope and inspiration. Thank you again to PJ. Thank you to listeners, and we'll talk to you all soon.